start again then.
Okay.
We were just talking about, well, I had sort of opened up by talking about how I very much enjoyed the narrative aspect of your book. I think it was maybe the strongest story we've read in the Football Scholars Forum so far, apart from maybe the anthology of the global writers on soccer that we had read, which had many good stories on it, some of which appeared in your book as well. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the use of Thuram and Zidane's lives as biographies on which you could spin off into different topics of French politics and French colonial history. And we were just going around and discussing some things that we had hoped to see more of or enjoyed in the book, and we had just thrown it out to David, who was starting with a question, but maybe we can bracket that question for a moment, and I can ask you sort of the question that we traditionally start off the Football Scholars Forum off with, which is just throwing it out to you to basically tell us maybe some things that didn't come out in the acknowledgement section of the book in terms of your decision to write it or any interesting aspects that came into making that decision with your other professional interests. And it's sort of an open question to tell us anything you'd like about the book.
Yeah, I mean, first, I say this in the acknowledgments, but Peter was a big part of this in the sense that I really, you know, and like many of you had not been working on football until 2006. I mean, it's something that I had obviously had a personal interest in and read a little bit about, but it was after the 2006 World Cup that I really decided to start working on it for, I think, obvious reasons. But really, I came to it as someone who was interested in French Empire and thinking about kind of the connections between the past of French Empire and contemporary politics in France. And I'd been a little frustrated in the sense that although a few people had written, French scholars of post-colonial France evoked soccer sometimes, and actually the most carefully was Paul Silverstein, who's written, I think, some of the better stuff on it and whose work I draw on a lot. But often it was a pretty cursory or a little bit simplistic read of it. So I wanted to just get into more fully into what football meant in France. And at first, I mean, really, it just started as an essay about the headbutt and about what I had kind of experienced and what had gone on around that. That was an essay I wrote. I just sort of shared it at a few French studies gatherings and got kind of positive response in it. And that's what kind of drove me to keep writing more about it. The other thing that happened is my original intention was really to write something about the way in which football in contemporary France, was, as I argue in the book, is to me at least probably the most significant or the broadest theater through which issues of race and empire are addressed in a kind of broad public way. And that was going to be the focus. And it's basically, like I think a lot of historians this happens to, once I started just reading and exploring the history, I just found all of these kind of webs and connections, both in the Caribbean, which is the place I had worked on most before, and I found those fascinating, and then in Algeria, West Africa. And so all these kinds of threads, these sort of overwhelming threads, actually came to bear on the book. And so I opted to sort of try to use Thuram and Zidane as a kind to try to hold it together a little bit, but obviously there's a lot of different stories here, and to use the, I mean, the most challenging thing I think was to figure out the connection between the narrative I wanted to tell about the World Cups and then these deeper historical aspects. So I suppose that's it. I mean, it was really fun to write, and it was great, and it's, you know, generous kind of community of scholars to help me try to grapple with, in the larger area of the history of football that I was really just learning about. So it's kind of the confluence of those two things that made the book. So, is everything okay? Are there construction going on or something? Sorry.
I was going to say, is somebody's kid drumming in the background?
Anyway, no problem. But so that's the, I guess that's all I would say. I mean, and I did want to, you know, I wanted to sort of experiment, or I tried to find a way to write something that, I mean, part of it, I guess in some broader sense, I think there were two kind of countervailing motivations. One was that I did want to speak to scholars who I know who work on France and empire and who I think are often pretty dismissive of sport, you know, as a kind of, I mean, not all of them, obviously, but in a broad, I've had enough sort of discussions to know that people, either they hadn't really thought of it or they thought of it in a pretty simple way. And then on the other side, I also, I mean, I felt like I wanted to render, to give a more complex view of contemporary France than you sometimes get here in terms of just the different layers of race and the complexities around that and what the banlieue is and you know what the insurrections in 2005 were about and how Algeria exists within France. So all those things I wanted to kind of provide just a more complex story to and seemed like football is the perfect place to kind of explore all the contradictions and ambiguities of, you know, place that on the one hand, I mean, it comes down to, you know, a place that can have the same football team can mean, you know, obviously all of these different things and something else again in 2010 as we learned. So
yeah, that was going to be my immediate follow-up question. Well, I also wanted to mention that it was really great to just personally read this book and see all the aspects of life for Michigan State that you mentioned as being a grad student here. It was really great to see that you had some experiences at the International Center watching the World Cup, and that was before I came. And you know, he's not here right now, but Kevin Johnson, you know, is obviously somebody who's been instrumental in fostering that viewership experience at the International Center. So I wanted to make that connection with the Football Scholars Forum. It was nice to see it in the acknowledgments. And also, I wanted to ask you two things. Did Turam did he jump at the opportunity to participate in the writing of this book? It seemed like he probably would have, based on sort of the political engagement that you see him take up most explicitly, you know, closer to his retirement age. And I also wanted to ask you the obvious question, you know, what is your take on 2010? And maybe we can end on that as well in terms of questions for the future. But what was your take on the events in South Africa?
Right. I mean, on the first, he was very helpful and supportive. And I had met him in 2006, that was actually part of the things that also inspired me to do the book. We did an interview with him for Esprit magazine in Barcelona, and that was, you know, kind of compelling. And so that gave me, I mean, I had known about him, obviously, and was interested in him, but that gave me a kind of more direct connection. And he actually came here. We brought him to Duke last year for a week in November, that was really extraordinary. So, you know, he didn't, it wasn't like he participated. He actually doesn't really read English, so it wasn't like I could give him the chapters or whatever to read, but I did ask him some questions, and I visited, you know, where he'd grown up and that kind of stuff to just get a sense of things. You know, he's always been, I think he's open, you know, quite open and encouraging about just sharing it. And it's obviously a pretty pro-Turam book. I mean, I think too much for some, actually, but, you know, I did see it as I just wanted to kind of foreground what I think is a pretty, you know, pretty unique and interesting political trajectory that he's had. You know, and actually, Turam was really among the many interesting voices in this past summer was Turam's, you know, extremely negative kind of response to the actions of the football team. And, you know, he was among the most, and in some ways it is actually an interesting continuation of the story in the book, and that Zidane was more kind of defended the players. Also had just basically chosen sides in some ways by advising the Algerian team, and having little to do with the French team. I read a little bit about the explosion of the French team this summer. And in some ways it's interesting because I think it's an interesting twist. I mean, it's still, I think I would say it's a continuation of the thesis of the book, which is that, like, once again, the soccer team through its total, you know, collapse came to be an incredible political symbol and a site for a lot of political debate in France. So the you know, in a totally different way than either 98 or 2006, once again, football kind of played this quite amazing political role in terms of just a broader moment involving the tensions around Sarkozy and the broader issue of race in France. I mean, the other thing I would emphasize that I think, and this was another continuation of the story, but a different leg, is, you know, there were in a way like these two French teams in the World Cup, because the Algerian team, you know, for the first time was really almost totally French-born, French kids who had grown up in France. You know, the game against the U.S., I think there were 10 on the field. There's one who had been born in Algeria. So in fact, all the only time there were big street celebrations around football in France this past year, for good reason, was around the Algerian team, both when they qualified and then I mean, not during the World Cup itself, but the qualification sort of celebrations were, even though France, it was the same night as France qualified, were all about Algeria. So there's a neat, I think it was an interesting maybe twist in terms of how that's operated and in against like kind of the next chapter of what I was trying to capture here. And maybe, so those are, you know, those are two things. I mean, It was funny in a way because at the beginning of this of the World Cup I thought, oh well, you know, there's going to be nothing. Basically, nothing's going to happen with the French team. They're just going to be terrible, and no one will talk about them, and that will be a drag since my book has just come out. But luckily they managed to get talked about even by being a terrible team. So
they got talked about a lot.
So I mean, it was interesting how, and I, you know, it was amusing to watch the sort of the England and all the English version, the Italian version, and the French version of a bad World Cup, each in their own kind of style. But certainly the French was sort of the most dramatic, I would guess.
Agreed. Well, we can start our rounds, and David was in the middle of asking a question, but you can start over, David.
Yeah, I think you provided an interesting segue to what my question was. I really appreciated the kind of take on French colonial power. I've, you know, read that kind of story from much different angles before, so it was nice to see football infused in that. My question was more about post-World Cup 2006 Zidane. Last night, just as a precursor, last night Jay-Z did a reading at the New York Public Library of his new book, with Cornel West kind of in tow. And one of the comments that he made was that whether or not hip-hop or rap explicitly addresses issues of racism, just simply having white children adore rap stars as kind of their embodiment of what they want to grow up to be makes it much more difficult for them to be racist. And so, you know, In a way, with Zidane's silence around issues of the treatment of Algerian or North Africans in France, he becomes, rather than actually speaking against, at least in my read, against the kind of marginalization of them in society, it's more of this symbolic way in which maybe a rap star who's embraced by suburban youth symbolically challenges kind of racial divisions in the U.S. More of a symbolic way of approaching or of challenging racism. So I was wondering, you know, obviously since then he's gone on to spend more time in Algeria, obviously, and advise the Algerian team. But has he done anything more to kind of vocalize his kind of politics around around marginalization?
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, not that I'm aware of. I mean, I think that it's unlikely that he'll ever, you know, take on that role in a super explicit way. I mean, obviously, there's been moments, you know, like the one I mentioned during Le Pen's campaign, where he, where kind of when pressed, he makes statements, you know, one way or the other. And you know, I think I was struck as one of the things I did, you know, was to go and just look. Go to the INA, which if any of you, you know, ever are able to use it for your research, it's really kind of an extraordinary. I'm sorry, the INA. It's basically the video archives that are at the National Library in Paris, and they just have an incredibly well indexed, you know, television. Basically, every minute of French television for the last couple of decades recorded there and available. So it was striking to kind of go back and look at him speak and see his interviews, and in some ways, I think. You know, he actually speaks a lot, you know, and he's sort of outspoken in a slightly different way, and he speaks in a bit of a kind of elliptical way, obviously. But he has often said things that I think are fairly clear to people who are watching. But it's obviously he's totally different than Thuram, and Thuram is totally different, obviously, than probably the vast number of athletes in general. I mean, he just sort of stands out in a particular way. But Zidane, I think, also, though, and I tried to emphasize this, I mean, I think that the question of how precisely to speak about Algeria in France is a really, you know, difficult one, right? I mean, it's a kind of it's different than the kind of issue that Thuram's the kind of issues that Thuram confronts because of the war and so forth. And I mean, even something as simple as Zidane saying before the France Algeria game that he kind of hoped for a tie wasn't in a kind of way rather radical. Like even if it was kind of cute at the same time, you know, there's these ways in which I think some of the things you've done, you know, are significant in that sense. But there's no doubt that the other side of it is just, and it's really hard to track or figure out what it means, but obviously the fact of having Zidane as, you know, the most popular Frenchman, as this kind of incredible figure, I think must have some impact. You know, like the question is exactly what impact it does. I mean, people can obviously contain that. You know, they can love Zidane and have all kinds of racist ideas, as, you know, some of the people I mentioned in the book do. You know, it doesn't necessarily lead to a shift, but it is a cultural shift at the same time, I think. You know, and again, the point about Thuram is that he sort of tries to take this next step to just explicitly trying to turn the idolization into a platform for other sorts of things. So, but it's going to be, I think, it'll be really intriguing to see, especially, you know, then with if his son ends up playing in Spain and what that would mean. And, you know, he's got all these different allegiances, and it will be interesting to see how his relationship with Algeria and maybe with the Algerian team, you know, evolves and what that means. And that's, you know, in some ways that makes sense, because it's if the Algerian team stays as it was in 2010, I mean, that's, it makes sense that that would become a kind of home for him. Like, that's the kind of place he's lived for a long time. And those players are people who share, in a sense, share a great deal with him, you know, maybe even more than the current French team in some ways. So.
Great. We can just continue down the list as I have it in front of me here on the Skype screen. Stephen, do you have anything?
Yes, I have a question, Laurent. In your chapter 4, actually, you do a pretty good trashing of Stoichkov. Since I'm a Bulgarian and I got to know him, I wanted to ask you a few questions. How did you? Was it based on interviews with Thuram et Desailly?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
Why did you put so much? I mean, that's actually a couple of pages.
Yeah. Well, it was partly, I mean, in some ways, Stoichkov was the unfortunate victim in some ways, but I wanted to kind of, you know, I was interested in these moments on the pitch. It figures pretty prominently in Desailly's autobiography and in Thuram's autobiography, both of them, and in interviews they've given too, but I mean, both of them make it a pretty big deal. So, I mean, in some ways it would, yeah, I should have probably, you know, if, I don't know if Stoichkov has a biography too, but...
Tell you a couple of things after that, because there are a couple of contradictive issues here.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I came to it partly, you know, not through my own reading of it, but through kind of their reading of it. It takes a couple pages partly because they all kind of went back to this 1996 European Cup as a kind of moment. I mean, not just because of Stoichkov, but Stoichkov and then Le Pen. Obviously, the bigger issue was the Le Pen comments, obviously, which became more significant. It was a way, I mean, in that chapter, just to try to connect, you know, sort of things on the pitch with the kind of broader politics and to think about how that generation of a team, you know, both personally... you know, came to some of the positions that they ultimately took up more politically, and especially in Thuram's case, and then also how they became this kind of broader symbol. And I mean, the Stoichkov incident was, I think, a part of that. But I can certainly imagine that they, you know, tailored it from their perspective to how they see it. So go ahead with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's a little bit over-exaggerated from their part. Don't forget that, you know, 93, the disaster of Parc des Princes is still a bad taste for a lot of Frenchmen, certainly for these players, because it was the end of a great generation. Papin, Gignola, Cantona, they never saw an international soccer after that. They couldn't go to the World Cup. Stoichkov, is he a dirty player? Guilty as charged. Is he stubborn? He has assaulted journalists. He has fought with players, with supporters, with everybody. But I honestly don't think that he's a racist. I think this is a gross exaggeration from Tuham and from the CE. Let me tell you why. I got to know him personally. I interviewed him a few times. And also, he's got a biography, probably very similar one to the one of the CE, in which actually he credits the CE as one of the great defenders in the world, one of the greatest defenders he has, played against. And the other thing is, if he was really a racist, I don't think he would have been really. He really likes to mentor young players. And when he was in Chicago Fire, DeMarcus Beasley would spend days with him at his house with his family. And if you talk to DeMarcus Beasley, he would, give a big credit to Stoichkov. So. The image that is painted by the CE at Tuam of a racist guy, and the other things, it just doesn't make any sense. So I honestly think that these players, because of frustration, they exaggerated. I can't believe that Stoichkov is a racist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think it's the same thing that comes up with Aragonés, right? Later, that there's kind of, and I think what's interesting is that in a sense. And I don't necessarily think a player has to be a racist in order to use race on the field either. You know, I mean, I think it's probably hard to figure out what actually is said on a football field and what's heard, right? And both sides are going to hear and say, you know, I mean, and this obviously comes up again with the headbutt issue, of course. I think it is interesting how each player would see each thing. I mean, I think in each of these cases, I think it's obviously, there's a way in which this book is obviously partial. You know, there's a bit of a Stockholm syndrome in the sense that it's reading through through Turam and Zidane more than anyone else. You know, so mm-hmm. I think I'm guilty of that. And partly, I almost just chose to do that because I wanted to make that the kind of core of the narrative. But certainly one could take an instant like that and multiply the perspectives on it and get probably a fuller, and more complicated thing. As I think almost all the incidents I talk about, you could, the same thing with Henri and Aragonés or the headbutt, there could be like, obviously there's a bunch of interpretations. And partly I decided at some point to just write a kind of more, in a sense is a more partial story, then, in part because of to create a kind of because I just felt like that was what was coming out and that was the kind of way that the story was going for me,
mm-hmm.
rather than necessarily taking fully a step back and trying to see all angles on a story. But I mean, I think it's a, and I also I should look at it again, but I hope I don't sort of say that I think personally Stoichkov is a racist. It's more like meant to talk about, however, the experience shaped, or whatever Desailly and Turam take from it. And later, I mean, it's interesting because Turam is always, Turam is actually pretty generous. And actually, Desailly was often, too, about those kinds of comments on the field, which is interesting. And so I think you might be right that the Stoichkov incident was about a particular kind of, intensity and frustration because of the Bulgarian.
The other thing, don't forget that they don't have common language. Stoichkov, I doubt that he earned a high school degree. His Spanish is very poor. Right. He's Bulgarian poor too, I should admit. And in South Africa, they were making fun of him when he was coaching after the post-game conference. So I just wonder in what kind of language he might have said this.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's why I said about, what's said and what's heard. And I mean, these guys are running around, there's obviously tons of room for misinterpretation, exaggeration, mm-hmm. and people, hearing maybe kind of what they want to hear, or on both sides. And I mean, part of it is that's of course part of the play between defenders
totally.
Between players is to maybe even leaving something a little uncertain. So I don't know. I mean, it'd be interesting to have a colloquium where we get them all together and talk about the incident or something.
That'll be interesting. One of the best, just to add something, one of the best images of Stoichkov was probably drawn by Franklin Foer in his book, How Soccer Explains the World, when he tried to interview him. This one I could believe because, he's definitely paranoid. He's definitely, he's got into conflicts with journalists, with players. He's broken the legs of young players. But, and this is really, this one I would believe. But, the comments of this Ian, it could be over exaggerated, and I'm glad that you explained me in all the details.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I really enjoyed your book. I'll definitely include chapters of it, several chapters in my future lectures.
How about Andrew?
Okay, let me see if I'm unmuted.
I can hear you.
Oh, okay. I really enjoyed it too. And again, especially appreciated the accessible writing and the narrative thread. I guess the thing that came up for me throughout was the juxtaposition of Thuram and Zidane and the way they position themselves as political figures. And obviously, the book makes a good case for Thuram being the more admirable in putting himself out there. But I always have some conflict because ultimately, they are footballers. And Zidane, there's a part of me that actually admires Zidane for holding back from being explicitly political. Because I think, as the thesis of the book suggests, we're going to project our political discussions and ideas onto the game when it is so prominent. And for, you know, it seems as though Thuram has sort of self-educated and gotten to a point where he's able to do it in a sophisticated way. But I actually worry when a lot of footballers go that far.
Yeah.
And So I guess that's one part of my question. And this is a little bit related, but a little bit random. I also have always been perplexed by the quote that you finished one of the very first chapters with from Thuram about football is the language of happiness, because his approach to it doesn't quite seem like that. I mean, he seems, you know, in a way, and throughout the book, he almost it's the language of politics. You know, it's something that is sort of intense in a way that. Almost, you know, I don't know. It's never struck me that he's terribly immersed in happiness when he's thinking about these things.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, it's funny. I went to see in May. I went to Paris and had spent an evening with him, and we went to a Paris Saint-Germain match. While we were sitting there, I just sort of said, like, do you miss playing, you know? And he said, like, oh, not at all. And he's like, actually, I'm sitting here looking at those guys and thinking, man, that looks exhausting, running back and forth like that all night long, you know? But it was kind of funny. But there's a way in which, two things. I hope that I didn't mean to kind of, you know, try to make Thuram more admirable than Zidane. I hope that I wanted to sort of make each of them, you know, as they are, you know, and I think there's absolutely nothing wrong. In some ways, I find, you know, I've never really been along. I mean, there are a lot of French activists, you know, who are angry that they always want Zidane to take a stand on something. And I've never felt that sympathetic to that read. I mean, I think Zidane, first of all, can do what he wants. And, there's no reason why he should feel like he has to speak rather than play or, you know, why he can't just be what he is. I mean, I don't think that should be a requirement. Just able to do it. I mean, if any of you have met him or spoken to him or whatever, you just realize he's just got a capacity to speak in a way that's just kind of remarkable. I think there are other players on the French team who could have done the same thing and just didn't want to. And I asked him that, you know, he said, well, I didn't, you know, you can imagine Henri or other people taking more, you know, firmer stances vis-a-vis French politics. And he just said, well, you know, none of them just really wanted to. I mean, Karembeu is the exception to some extent, you know, in the sense that he says a lot of more forceful stuff, So, you know, I think that's part of it is that I think part of the goal was just to render them in their complexity, but also to suggest I think they have different places from which they could speak. And I do really think that the question of Algeria in France is certainly different than the question of the Caribbean in France or, you know, the question of blackness in France are different things. In terms of the politics of the language of happiness, you know, I think it's part of a broader thing, almost like an economy of joy versus work in football that is itself a kind of political ideal. But I think part of that is about saying, you know, what different players have said over the years, which is almost an attempt to preserve, you know, the joy at the center of the game against, you know, all the money and the corruption and the, you know, all these kinds of things that get put on it. Right. And the sense that at some level, part of the job is to retain some place of play and joy, you know, despite at the same time as they're well aware of all the other things that are structuring the game, you know. So I do think, to me, it seems somewhat consistent. I mean, in that he always tried to emphasize, and you know, even in his post game talks, you know, would try to emphasize that sense of this as a space of or should be a space of joy, right? And as well as of tragedy, right? But a kind of space of that wasn't going to necessarily be captured or contained by all the forces that surrounded it. So I think, you know, you know, he always exudes a kind of sense of disbelief about how that space could turn into such a huge thing. And it is kind of, you know, when he was here, it was wild to realize just how, you know, literally just that moment on the football field in 1998, even in like a high school in Durham, had kind of basically given him this like almost permanent, you know, status as a kind of idol, that is kind of amazing. And it's interesting just to see him reflect on that. And he's not a, you know, like any other person, he's not an uncontradictory one. I mean, he obviously has different takes on things at different times. And so I think I think there are different, you know, things battling it out, I guess, in him about how he sees it. Anyway, but I hope that answers the question a little bit.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I appreciate the idea of him, that itself. I read it as sort of a statement that it's not that serious, but you're saying there's a way in which it actually is a political statement in itself, which is interesting to think about.
Peter.
The bells are tolling.
The bells are tolling.
Oh, jeez.
Sorry, I think that's me. I can mute. Sorry.
That sounds like Michigan State, doesn't it? Yeah.
or my hometown.
Right. Either it's Italy or Michigan State. It's not Durham. Yeah.
It's actually Portland, sorry.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
No. I'll mute and get rid of it.
Yeah, shut those Catholics up, would you? Blasphemy. I learned a great deal from the book, and I mean, I could go on and on, but I won't, because we've already covered quite a bit. I do want to come back to the schizophrenic quality of the book with these two biographies of Turam and Zidane in a moment. What I really like about it, and why I'm going to be using it in my global soccer class, the capstone seminar we're doing in the spring, is really the way that Laurent writes. I mean, you are both essayistic and scholarly at the same time. It's I think something that most of us really strive to get to, and we never quite get there. And I think it's just wonderful to see how it's done, so that you can, you know, try and get there. But also this constant humanizing of the actions and voices of a really representative cast of characters. I mean, one moment we're on the right, one moment we're on the left, another moment we're smack in the middle. You know, contradictions and ambiguity are good and to be embraced, and I think that's really wonderful. From a historian's standpoint, I really like the first couple of chapters the most, frankly. I like the stories of Jules Rimet, you know, in the trenches of World War I with the Senegalese soldiers fighting for the French. I mean, it really puts a human face on French internationalism at that time. And, you know, you think of the French as founding FIFA, you think of the French as creating the World Cup and the IOC and all these things that are now a staple of global culture. But, you know, the way that Laurent presents it is really nice. And I knew a little bit about Eboué, of course, from his time in French Equatorial Africa and elsewhere. But I had no idea about his importance in promoting sport in the French Caribbean. So that was really new to me. And also just thinking of Aimé César and César and Léon Damas, the founders of the Negritude movement. You know, one of the things that they did as youngsters was to found a Good Hope football club in Martinique. I mean, how cool is that? So I was running around the house with my fists clenched when I read that. So that was amazing. The second half of the book, though, worked in parts for me. you know, this I guess the material you're working with is just so different, because Turam is out there saying these really intelligent things, and he's politically conscious, he's a public intellectual in many ways, and on the other hand, Zidane doesn't say much, and he's relatively apolitical. So, you know, there were a lot of times when I was seeing a kind of really historian-hearted work trying to balance the scales a bit, but it just didn't seem like the sources allowed it. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about how you deal with on the one hand, you want to produce this balanced view, but on the other hand, you know, the sources just don't seem to allow you to do that. And that's a tension that, you know, we tackle in a whole number of cases. And then my question for you really is, well, there are a couple, but the first one was, since I learned so much about France, are there other forms of popular culture, say various forms of music or art, that also symbolize, if not constitute, this kind of what you call the promise of egalitarian meritocracy of soccer, or this kind of elusive, you know, liberal multicultural democracy in France, or is soccer a really unique space in which this kind of thing happens? That's my first question. Mm-hmm. So soccer, how it relates to society. And then the other thing has to do with the Pologuane disaster of 2010, which I witnessed in person on a bitterly cold night on June 17th. And believe me, you know, with 25,000 Mexicans in this 40,000 seat stadium, I got stuck in the section with all the French fans. and watched it with my friend Sergio from Mexico City, who is the most anti-nationalist person you'll ever meet. And anyway, long story. But was this the symbol, this match of the end of this utopia of the French soccer republic, or do these things go in cycles? You know, what's in store for the future of France and the role that football will play in it?
Right. Well, those are great questions. First, thank you so much for your response. I mean, it means a lot, obviously, coming from you, and so I really appreciate it. I think, you know, I was frustrated in the same way about the disjuncture between the two figures. And part of it's a simple. I mean, you know, what Zidane is just represented almost on this kind of overwhelming scale. You know, I mean, what needed to become was a kind of cultural studies, you know, a kind of postmodernist cultural studies person or something, and just to sort of to look at the multiplication of Zidane's images. And there's a kind of way in which there's this overwhelming, you know, presence of his figuration and all that kind of stuff. And I mean, I joke. I think I mentioned this. You know, this French scholar who talks about the need for a whole field called Zidaneology, you know, which would have to grapple with that. But it's, you know, compared to Turam, which is a kind of much more a certain kind of trajectory. Also, in terms of, so, you know, Zidane has been written about a ton from different angles, including, you know, having generated these extremely negative biographies, you know, sort of like the secret unauthorized biography of Zidane that has been published. And, you know, there's this profusion of stuff around him that in some ways I think at a certain point I just like couldn't really handle, you know? So it's true that you know, and I tried to sort of to give some balance to it, but I really wanted to give the Algerian story, you know, a front and center, but they are so different. And Turam in some ways, I think some reviewers have commented this on it too. I mean, it's obviously in some ways I'm more comfortable with Turam. I think honestly, because I'm also a lot more comfortable with the Caribbean, which I've worked on for a long time, and I think I kind of get a lot about that story that I might not get about the Algerian story. You know, even though I've read about it, but it's not a place that I'm as sort of intimately familiar with. So, but yeah, I certainly appreciate that problem, and you know, kind of tried to do the best I could. But I think it's a serious issue. So. The question about 2010. I mean, it was funny. We gave a presentation here the other day about contemporary France, and I actually showed a clip from the France-Romania game. You know, the European Cup qualifying. And what was really interesting about that is that that actually drew a massive audience. You know, there's like an, I think it drew 8 million viewers in France. They won the game against Romania, which, you know, they always tie Romania, basically. So this was a big deal. The stadium was packed. The team, you know, while it had a lot of new players, of course, is in many ways the same kind of team, right? You know, it's got players from, there's a player from Reunion, and Lily Cremy, who scored the goal against Romania, is another Antillean. And, you know, there's a slight shift in that Benzema is back, and there's a few more West Africans than Antilleans, but it's still, you know, in some ways, you know, there's not that much different about how this team looks or where it comes from, and so I think what you have, and it's all, I really think this is what defines for me French football in the last 20, 30 years, is just these incredible, you know, it's, we were talking about a schizophrenic book. It's like a bipolar team, you know, like where you have these moments of greatness followed by these just utter cataclysms, you know. And it seems like, I'm not sure why French football has that capacity to go up and down so quickly, but it is kind of interesting. And I think that, so in that sense, I think, and it's always available, you know. But, I mean, the thing about it, and probably I don't emphasize this quite enough in the book, it can be used, you know, to the most sort of vile ends. You know, I mean, it can obviously be mobilized. The fact of this multi-ethnic team can certainly be mobilized when they lose to justify all kinds of, as it kind of was this summer, right? Where the story that people like Finkielkraut told was, you know, these are unruly kids from the banlieue who don't know how to respect their elders. You know, and the racial reading of that team did, you know, make it circulated quite a bit in France. So, you know, wasn't the only one, obviously, but so I think it's just going to keep being kind of both things. And, you know, of course, the danger is that when a team loses, it can easily be attacked. And then on the other hand, when they win, it changes the calculus. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens. But I was struck by those Euro games to just see how quickly, you know, you might think that French fans would just skulk home and not follow football again for another decade or something. Like, that would be a justifiable response, but seemingly they just, you know, all bought tickets and showed up again ready to be punished. So I suppose that's true for a lot of teams.
So is that an indication that soccer is unique in this
Yes, I'm sorry,
understand the connection between popular culture and politics, or does it share some characteristics with other forms?
Right, yes. I in many ways, I think it's quite unique. I mean, obviously, the closest realm would be that of music, right, in the sense of something that's a real popular form and crosses a lot of boundaries. So hip-hop music, you know, various artistic forms. Actually, comedy is actually one of the places I would go to first, which even more than hip-hop, because it unites a lot of people. So kind of stand-up comedy and various forms of comedy in France are actually able to bridge barriers. But none of them quite have the same charge of, you know, the thing about football that just nothing else does is the kind of condensation around the symbolics of the nation, you know, and the fact that this team, you know, is France and is profoundly French, you know, it's just like there's nothing else that does that in the same way. So, right, a lot of people can just think of hip-hop artists as un-French or as on the margins of France, but the prodding and the push that the fact that this team is representing France does, and what the, you know, the kind of problem that poses for everyone from Le Pen to the socialists to just commentators, I think is pretty unique, right? And I think it is one of the things about football that, you know, that just doesn't, you can't find another realm that quite does it in the same way. So while the multicultural or the kind of celebration of different stuff is certainly present in other parts of French life, it intersects with less force with a kind of more nationalist symbolism. So, you know, I think that's what's unique about this realm.
That's great. And Alex, I hope you're taking close notes about this.
Absolutely. And I have some follow-up questions for you, a little bit closer to my research interests. Something that you have a 2.5 pages that I'm going to look over again and again in the Crossings chapter about the public service mission of sport and its historical trajectory. And you talk about, you know, its recurrence under the socialist government from 97 and 92. And I wanted to ask sort of for maybe sort of a prediction, but also sort of a discussion of maybe the current state of how this public service mission of sport has played under, has played out under Sarkozy, and maybe how it intersects or how it relates to the other league structures in Europe, and especially the academy systems in France have been something that have been pointed to as very unique in the European system, something that has been sort of resilient in the face of increasing privatization or speculation on youth players. And I'm sure that is, you know, the trend is moving more towards that in France, or maybe it's not, but maybe a discussion of how that's playing out under the Sarkozy government. And if there is, you know, this moment of mobilization that you've identified in 98 as the World Cup team rallies around sort of a political lightning rod that can be used for an anti-racist measures, has it ever been, or you see it being co-opted for a more explicitly economic argument about the role of sport in French society, that it should be absolutely a public service that does not go away and never goes away? Or has the anti-racist message sort of been a little bit more monopolistic in the political mobilization that it can gin up in soccer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And I'm learning more all the time, and I need to learn a lot more about the academy systems in other places. And obviously, there may be some homogenization, right? I mean, I think in some ways that there is, well, it's hard under Sarkozy. I mean, you know, I quote Sarkozy talking about, you know, lambasting the policemen of Toulouse for playing soccer with the kids they should be arresting, right? You know, this kind of, so there is this certainly he's taken a lot of, you know, he's attacked a lot of the kind of public programs that have helped support sports as a mechanism for just sort of social assistance, if you will, or whatever in the banlieue. But the fact that there's been so much placed in the banlieue and so much sense of soccer as a public good, I mean, in some ways, is connected to the anti-racist message. In fact, in some odd kind of structural way, they're fundamentally connected, right? In the sense that some of those programs are what has helped produce this multi-ethnic team, right? So there's an interesting thing there. And in some ways, I mean, that was part of what was fascinating about the 2010 discussion, was that you know, it was almost like in a very caricatural way, people were suddenly taking stock of the fact that, you know, through basically structural effects in some ways, through choices on the part of the FFF, they had in fact, you know, gotten to a place where you had a team that most of players who had basically all grown up in the banlieue, and then these coaches, and this particular coach, right, who kind of was kept in place in this despite everything for so long, despite and this everything. Kind of sense of, you know, this kind of sense of just the corruption of the system. And you know, it's not to endorse the kind of super the caricatural ways that people talked about that, but at the same time, it is certainly an interesting social reality and sociological reality about football in France, and one that will continue. I mean, there's almost no doubt that it's going to continue. We were watching the World Cup when I was in South Africa. We watched one of the games with Joseph Antoine Bell, you know, who was the Cameroonian, who's a goalkeeper at Olympique de Marseille and on the Cameroon team for a while. And it was really interesting to hear him talk about that issue, because he had a kind of sense that, like, there is indeed a kind of issue about, you know, socialization and what the, you know, growing up in the academies and what that's gonna, how is that gonna affect people and so forth. And I think that I mean, that whole world deserves really close attention, and I think it's really interesting. And I think again, I mean, the part of the tilt of the book, you know, maybe unfortunately is part, I mean, obviously this is a book about people who succeeded, right? There's based around the stories of people who succeeded. And there's a much, you know, darker side, obviously, to the story of the academies. And, you know, I know people who visited them who've just described them as these really kind of pretty nightmarish places. So, there is that whole other side of the academy system that we need to think about as kind of holding, you know, I don't know, holding these kids, most of whom are not going to go on and do anything in the athletic career. So, you know, in an interesting way, they might, you know, as especially because right now things are so rough in France and things seem to be degrading rapidly. Like, it'll be interesting to see whether, you know, the broader unease about various other structures, you know, that are there, that are supposed to be dealing in some ways, or that have welcomed banlieue youth in various ways, you know, whether these academies come under scrutiny in that way or not. I mean, I think it'll be intriguing, and it'd be intriguing for some of the players who's come through them to talk more exactly about what they what they were outside of the story. Now there's a great film called that was made about Zidane's, you know, class in the academy. And you know, that's really good because you sort of see that basically none of them, you know, there's Zidane and then there's a bunch of guys who are working in the post office or in, you know, local municipal
things or whatever. And I mean,
you know, so it's like, yeah.
No, I think, you know, race took front and center in the book, rightfully slow. And I think you did a fantastic job with it. And I think you've done also a great job on giving us enough context about what else is going on in this team that is a result of a soccer empire that is so crucial in the history of French football and the relationship with the banlieues and the neighborhoods. It was really great to see some of the parallels with what I've been looking at in Argentina, but also some of the really dramatic disconnects from what I've seen in Argentina. I mean, the neighborhood organizations that you talked about in the banlieue as being a target for destruction during protests, it made me take a step back when I reread it. And, you know, I was very used to reading about neighborhood clubs as sort of, you know, centers of galvanizing this neighborhood identity that was so strongly tied to space and place. And, you know, we see that in the banlieue as well, but then we see, you know, as you're talking about in this film, La Haine, you know, the ransacking of this facility sort of struck me as, wow, this disconnect from what else I'd been seeing, and maybe an interesting aspect of France and how debates over sports' role in a more social and economic setting in the neighborhood, you know, is unique from other places that I've looked at. And yeah, you've given a bunch of great context to follow those threads.
Mm-hmm. And part of it's just this broader, you know, the incredible presence of the state in France and just all kinds of levels, right? And that's one of the things that, you know, it's one of the various differences between the U.S. and France in some ways, is that it's not like the state isn't highly present in the banlieue. I mean, it's present in problematic ways, but it's highly present as opposed to being, you know, sort of absent. And so that's intriguing, I think, and something to really look at more closely. The other thing is just this demographic, you know, there's this basic, like, this encounter between the generational shift, the kind of race, I guess, and generation in France that's really coming to the fore, right? Which is just that, you know, in some ways, the younger you go, like the more you go down the age scale, the more you find a kind of mixed, you know, people of African or Caribbean or whatever background. And of course, the youth in France are the ones who are suffering the most, right? Who have the highest levels of unemployment, who are facing like this real kind of wall and a kind of dead end, and who have been incredibly mobilized. You know, like they were actually like middle schoolers who went on strike a few weeks ago because of the retirement reform, which if you think about it is kind of crazy, but like, in other words,
had that sort of consciousness about Social Security in this country.
Exactly. They were shutting down their schools because of Sarkozy was raising the retirement age. Right. But there is this real sense. So, and there I think is another way in which, I mean, the thing is that football players, among other things, are youthful, you know, and they do tend to be some of the only people who are like on a prominent national stage who are young, and who are very young, you know, it's at times, and that's another part of this, is just the kind of, and as the issue of the generations, you know, and so generation, race, and then the kind of structural stuff all come together pretty potently in France right now. And it strikes me as very likely that the football team will keep being a place where those things get, you know, kind of projected onto.
We can sort of open it up to David, Stephen, Andrew, if you had any follow-up questions, or Peter as well.
Just quickly, that film about the Zidane and his academy cohort, do you know if that's available anywhere, or is that something that you saw randomly?
It was, you know, it was on TV in France, and it is sold in France, or has been at least. Lately, I've been trying to get I've been trying to get a hold. Get a version of it, and I haven't been able to. I don't think it was widely released. So it might be the kind of thing. I mean, luckily, it would be the kind of thing you could actually watch if you went to the Paris, you know, INA, like you know, which because it was on television. But it, unfortunately, as far as I can tell, there wasn't a lot of distribution. There's a couple of great films that were made. I mean, there's one that I cite a couple times that's Les Yeux dans les Bleus, that was just kind of like in, you know, following the different campaigns. And that, I think, is out of, maybe it was reissued again, but some of those, there really was a remarkable group of, I mean, of documentarists working on that. So I think, you know, now a lot of the stuff might just be put on the web or Vimeo or something like that, but some of the stuff has fallen between the cracks. So maybe someone will, maybe it'll appear someday on YouTube or Vimeo or something, which would be nice. So.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to see more the Academy, the whole cohort, and the socialization, like you said.
Right, yeah, and if I remember correctly, there's like one, you know, maybe there's one or two, besides Zidane, there's one or two who actually got professional contracts, and neither of them, you know, went very far. So it's really kind of amazing, because you might imagine, you know, and then other academies, of course, produced a few players who went on, you know, to success. So I guess it depends, but people, you know, like Makalele and Turam kind of knew each other at a college for a while, you know, so there are a couple cases where you get more than one, but you know, the statistics are clearer than that, right? Like, as with African migration or whatever else, you know, like it's a really, really bad likelihood that you're, you know, it's a really low likelihood that it's going to work out in any positive way. So,
I have a question
for Laurent. Laurent, probably until the World Cup in France in 98, politicians would ignore soccer. And all of a sudden, you know, Le Pen viciously attacked the French national team, as you described, skillful in the book. And then that backfired, obviously, the extreme right split. After he repeated that after the World Cup in France, and there were a lot of unhappy people after obviously what happened on the World Cup with the French team. In what way do you think politicians can kind of use for their political agendas in the future, Les Bleus, the French national team?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of the lesson I wanted to foreground in the book is just how unpredictable that is, right? Attempting to use, I mean, certainly, I'm sure politicians will continue to try to use them in all kinds of ways. And Le Pen has done it a lot, right? Because not only is there the 1996 and comments, but also and 2006, but also the, you know, the fact that he launched his presidential campaign from in front of the Stade de France after the France-Algeria game.
Exactly, yes.
It's pretty striking, right? You know, that's a kind of pretty striking sign of. So, you know, it's just, but it's a risky game, I think, for the right wing to attack a soccer team. I mean, it might seem like a good idea, but then if they do well, it turns out not to be such a good idea, right? So,
It's not just Le Pen. If you remember, after the World Cup, Thierry Henry was driven straight to Sarkozy after the disaster.
Right,
not just him. It's like I said, they were ignored completely, and all of a sudden, everybody tries to
co-opt. Yeah. And this summer was really interesting, I thought, for all those reasons. You know, I mean, first of all, because, you know, the French team did they acted in such a French way by having like a work stoppage, right? You know, like in any other realm of labor, people would have, you know, many people anyway would have defended the right to not work, right? And to not work in protest, right? I mean, it's a labor action, right? But of course, the language in France, I mean, the response was basically that soccer players should be like soldiers, right? They're not supposed to like not follow orders. They don't have the right to refuse, right? So that was kind of interesting. And you know, the role of Evra, who is, I think, a really interesting figure, and Anelka, of course, and Abidal. I mean, each of the choices, and then definitely Thierry Henry's, you know, sort of immediate trip to go see the president, and in order to exonerate himself, sort of maybe a little sheepishly, but so all those. I mean, I thought it was a really it played out in a really fascinating way, and. You know, it's just once again, it's not a super clear connection. It's just that I think that it turns out again and again that the realm of football is one onto which all kinds of the political present, you know, are projected. You know, so, and that was the case this summer, because, I mean, obviously, I mean, you know, right, that the kind of situation that's going on in France right now is like really intense in all kinds of levels, and there's a real sense of an impasse and all sorts of things. And so, you know, in some ways, in a weird sort of way, the 2010 World Cup experience went a little bit with the 2010 French experience more broadly. So, as it did in 2002, I mean, it's almost like this weird symbiosis sometimes between the team and the and I think that may be even a little bit true, right? That in some ways, the morale of a team that goes to play in a World Cup, you know, does respond a little bit to what the political situation is and how they feel, you know, in really, I mean, that may not be true in every country or whatever, but I think there's got to be some. I think it must affect things somehow, you know. So anyway, and I think that's interesting too to think about how what it means for a group of people to try to represent a country and for them as they're thinking about, well, what does that country represent at this time for us, or what do we represent in that country as well. So. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think the only thing we can predict is that politicians will probably keep trying to use football, and that about at least about half the time it'll backfire. So,
David, did you have a second?
Nope.
I just wanted to ask real quick if Peter doesn't have anything to add.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments, one question. I'll keep it quick, brief and quick. One was, you mentioned Thierry Henry. If you were to add an epilogue to Soccer Empire, or in a new edition, you get to write another chapter that talks about 2010 and the qualification and so on, what were the kind of discussions that Henri's handball generated in France, number one, because I followed mostly the English speaking press on this, so I'm intrigued by what you have to say about that. And then thinking of Henri, he was of course the star, along with some of the veterans of 1998, in the Euro 2000 triumph, which is a very painful one for me.
I'm sure. Yeah.
Given the fact that we still don't know where the Swedish referee found those 4 minutes of added time that allowed
another Swedish referee, right? They're dangerous because it was a Swedish referee at the Ireland France game too, actually.
There are a lot of people who don't think that's a coincidence, especially Swedish connoisseurs of the game who still don't understand why that man even has a FIFA international badge. And let's not go back to the history of World War II, because then we get really messy.
Into trouble, yeah.
But why so little in the book about Euro 2000? It seems to me that that there was a space there for you to go into some different directions, and you chose not to. The focus was firmly on 1998.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I there's certainly more with Euro 2000, and part of it was, you know, just because I needed to get to 2006, and the book was already twice as long as I promised my editors it would be, and, you know. But I do think that event was really interesting. I mean, it's partly hard to figure out what the links are. I mean, how it linked up with the political, because things were already starting to shift in a kind of interesting way in 2000. So it's true that generally in France, I think that was experienced as a kind of like after 98, or, you know, like a continuation of 98 with some of the same basic themes, although a little less, you know, enthusiasm and so forth. But certainly that team, I think, deserves a lot more, you know, and that whole competition could certainly deserve a lot more examination. So, I mean, I agree with you with that. The handball, I mean, again, really fascinating. And in some ways, you know, I think the French press and the French discussion followed the discussion of elsewhere. I mean, there was, you know, the outcry was similar within France, people ashamed, people apologizing, people not believing, you know, followed by then a second round of people saying, well, of course, but, you know, we can't quite vilify him. This happens in soccer, and, you know, so forth. I mean, it followed a little bit of the same trajectory. Certainly, though, it helped create a sense of just depression, you know, about the whole enterprise. So, you know, there were really no celebrations. I mean, that night, you know, Marseille and Paris were full of people celebrating the Algerian qualification. A lot of celebrations in the streets, really wild celebrations, you know, in Marseille in particular. And, you know, you might have, you know, there were a few French flags around, it seems, but it was really like a celebration of the whatever French-Algerian team, however you want to describe it. So, and I think partly that was because nobody really felt like celebrating after that match, even if some, you know, people were then, I guess, still glad they were in the World Cup or whatever. I think that was actually part of, and then they went, I think partly they did go to the World Cup with this like burden of feeling like, I mean, they had to do something really special in the World Cup to sort of, you know, to sort of get over that qualification. And then it didn't really happen. Although Henri was one of the few players on the team who occasionally had some moments during the World Cup. But interestingly though, I do think, I mean, one of the things, the frustrations at the World Cup itself was that, you could literally see the French team shift attitude when Henri was on the pitch. And it was this kind of strange thing that even though I know he's, you know, super old or whatever, but it was a strange thing that to see Domenech not use that a little more, you know, since it was obvious that the mood of the team totally changed when Henri was there, and that he was kind of the only one capable of giving a kind of moral center to the team, you know, in some ways. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it'll be interesting. Henri has always puzzled me in a certain way, because I think, you know, he's obviously very, very eloquent. You know, he speaks well. I mean, he and Thuram at least always said that he kind of shared, I think Henri shared a lot of Thuram's own, you know, leanings or political sentiments or whatever, and yet never, you know, I mean, he did obviously the anti-racist campaigns within football, but didn't take that other step, and always remained pretty close to, even, you know, even in the famous moment in 2005, when all the Antillean players, you know, went for the game to Martinique and were interviewed at the airport about the riots, you know, he's kind of the one guy who didn't say anything. You know, Malouda said stuff, Abidal said stuff, Thuram made a speech, of course, and Henri kind of just didn't want to talk. You know, it's interesting, like that he has that. Play. I don't know if this was true, but I remember here. I think I heard in South Africa told that. The funniest part of one of the funniest things about the French team was that Henri, they kind of routed them back through this strange routing in coach back to France, the team, you know, like they had to sit, I guess, next to crying babies in the back of the plane or something as punishment. But apparently Henri just chartered a jet for himself and flew home, you know, sort of on his own. So that's a kind of funny sense of the class differences on the team, you know, and what Henri could permit himself. So, but
I wonder how much the Nike contract for Henri and the Adidas contract for Zidane impact the amount of talking that they do on some of these heavy political issues.
Yeah, that is a good point. It's true, because the thing about Thuram is he never had those kind of contracts. You know, he was very well paid, obviously, but he never had those kind of deals. And I do think that in some ways left him maybe freer, because I suspect that both Henri and Zidane, I mean, there must be stipulations there about those things. So I would love to see somebody write about, I mean, I think Henri would be a great subject, and that, and the 2000 euro, you know, would be great subjects for more digging around. So
great, thanks.
I had a quick question about another piece of work that you've done, your review essay in the Journal of Latin American Caribbean Anthropology. It's for everyone else, it's titled Football in Latin America: Field and Its Challenges, and I just sort of wanted to use that as a springboard to ask you about what might come next in terms of your research interests with soccer and sort of their, you know, I know your main field is closer to the Caribbean, and you know, it'd be great to see, you know, a flowering of scholarship about some of the historical context you've already sort of really done a great job of providing in the first two chapters of the book, to maybe have a more complete history of the Caribbean soccer scene, maybe as Peter's just done with African Soccerscapes. And, you know, in this essay you talk, this essay sort of follows books that have very, very different points. And I also wanted to mention the essay because you reviewed Roger Magazine's Golden and Blue Like My Heart, which we talked about last year. And, you know, I think something that he did really well is, you know, had a very everyday approach, partly because it's an ethnography and he's looking at fan culture, but also because he wanted to use Pumas fans to analyze about Mexican society. I was wondering if basically you had any plans to take that sort of an approach to the Caribbean, one that was more rooted in sort of an everyday club or sort of history of clubs approach, rather than, you know, these large political events that you've so wonderfully demonstrated the World Cup can be in France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I right now, I mean, I'm writing mostly other things at this point. Although, I mean, partly I am at least at the very least trying to really make sport and soccer in particular a part of, I mean, I'm writing a history of Haiti right now and then doing this broader Caribbean history, and just, you know, to make sure that that angle gets its due in a kind of broader historical narrative and in precisely the ways that you're suggesting, which is, you know, as part of this kind of fabric of social life and community life and as civic institutions. I'd really like, and I'm constantly looking for stuff about soccer in Haiti, which has a really interesting history. And, you know, not just, I mean, partly the history of clubs and of players. I mean, they've obviously had not a great, you know, they've been around occasionally in World Cups and gold cups and that kind of stuff, but it's more, you know, everyone jokes in Haiti that the national team is Brazil, and although the other national team is Argentina, but the kind of the rivalries among Haitians between Brazil and Argentina are incredibly interesting and intense, and I have friends who were there during the World Cup this year, and you know, there were huge street celebrations when Argentina lost in Haiti. So like, wow. Like there were celebration, there were, you know, they were sad when, but there were like people with Brazilian flags in the streets celebrating when Argentina lost, right? So there's like, they have a pretty strong fan base in Haiti. So that would be an interesting, I mean, sort of like Haitian fan culture would be interesting. There's a famous case in 2006, a kind of peace match that when the Brazilian team came to play a friendly in Haiti, you know, it was a game where you could get in free if you brought a gun. So it was part of a project of trying to disarm gangs and stuff. So there's all kinds of like ethnography around that. I did have one of the people on the blog, Laura Wagner, who's an ethnographer working in Haiti, and she wrote a couple of dispatches about the scene in Haiti. So I'd like, you know, that's just something I'd like to explore. I don't know in what format exactly. And obviously, like, the blogging format that I started doing on soccer politics has been, you know, I'll try to still comment on French football and, you know, keep things up to date in that sphere. I don't know if it'll take a more academic focus. And then, as you know, I mean, I think you know Jeffrey Ritchie. I mean, I'm working with actually two students at Duke who are doing dissertations on soccer. So through them, just trying to get, you know, get more work out there. One's working in Argentina and one's working on Spain. I was really struck in the French Caribbean context of how important this was as a kind of social history, you know, of communities and a great way into that. So.
Great. Thanks. Does anyone else have any final comments for Laura?
You said quickly that your interactions with other French studies scholars, they often are sort of deprecating of sports. How's the response been to this book?
It's actually been, yeah, and I shouldn't, it was more that there's one or two books by scholars who I really like, actually, but where they would kind of like mention something about the French soccer team, but get like really huge things wrong, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like this, like the kind of thing
the
where like
96 World Cup,
right. Or whatever, you know, these kind of odd, it's as if it's a thing, you know, like anything else they would have taken a little care to, like, I don't know, go on Wikipedia or something to, I mean, it was, you know what I mean? It was, it's this kind of strange thing in which it's maybe just not taken as serious, you know, it just wasn't seen as serious, something that you could put in for a little flavor. But but generally I've had good response. I mean, I see, you know, and you all probably have this experience too. Like, I still will give talks sometime. I gave a talk at Berkeley and the chair of the department, you know, spent the dinner explaining to me that sport was an opium or a narcotic, actually, in this case she referred to it as. But so there's still like this funny, you know, you do encounter a sort of funny set of responses that I think we've all encountered. So it's on the other hand, I mean, the nice thing in French studies is that 1998, you know, everybody kind of remembers and thinks about 1998. It is sort of startling to me that no one had written a book like this. I mean, obviously I shouldn't say that, because there was an edited collection and then Greg Hare included some of it. So it wasn't like nobody had paid attention to it, but it's, you know, and then there's a new generation of French scholars, you know, organized around the We Are Football site and others who are doing a lot of good work. So, but you know, it's, to me, it's such a, and the good thing is that a lot of French study scholars, you know, at the very least they were there in 98 or they know about 98. And so they kind of are aware on that level. but hopefully, I mean, I've gotten positive. A lot of people who've read the book just, you know, have told me that they just weren't aware that soccer was that, you know, that important. And the whole story of the whole early history of the sport having come out of France and Remy and all that kind of stuff is stuff that, you know, it connects with people's interests. And so hopefully it'll just, you know, clue people in a little more to the importance of it. So.
I think it's remarkable when you discover that intellectuals are tuned out of some pretty important things. It's just amazing the kind of bubbles we create for ourselves at times.
In the introduction, you know, has, as you can see, a bit of a chip on its shoulder. But I mean, I did want to write an introduction that would be a bit of a brief about saying, we can't continue to have this attitude about this. If we're going to be serious scholars of the contemporary world. This is preaching to the choir on that. But I mean, I think it is important to, and I did want to write a book that would, I was hoping that I could write a book that people who had never thought about soccer or cared about soccer would read, and hopefully, you know, just it would change a little bit how they would see it. So they might pick it up just because they're interested in race in France or whatever, and then bring something to them that they hadn't thought about before. So.
And it's really important for those of us who don't read French, no, or don't speak French and are not familiar with the literature in French, to have books like yours in English that open up all new connections and questions and comparisons. So it's that's an additional benefit.
And that was one of the reasons for the narrative style. You know, I mean, I there was a side of me that just wanted to kind of document and tell the 1998 World Cup and the 2006 World Cup, you know, just as a kind of, you know, the old school historian's job of putting on paper a kind of historical experience that, you know, that otherwise might a little bit, it could be, I mean, it's not going to be forgotten, but it could go away or just sort of reach, you know, be distorted or whatever. I wanted to kind of just give an account of that, that Americans could read about. Because of course, you know, I think those of us who follow football remember it, but a lot of Americans, I think, don't quite remember it or haven't quite fully integrated it. So just to provide that for those who want to know kind of what happened, to have that there. So, Stephen, were you going to ask something, Stephen?
Yes. Is there any interest in France by editors? Has somebody approached you with an offer to translate your book into French and to offer it to the French readers?
I have talked to a couple of editors and a few people. I mean, Pap Ndiaye, who reviewed it for ZD, was going to talk to some folks. And I had a few conversations, not with editors, but just with other scholars when I was there in May. So maybe something will pan out. I mean, it's always a little tough, just financially. You know, you have to find a publisher. I mean, because it's expensive to do a translation. Finding someone who's willing to do it. And I mean, what Peter was saying earlier. I did talk to one. I mean, I know somebody at a pretty big editing house and who looked at it, but actually said, responded that he thought people, intellectuals don't like football, and people who mm-hmm. like football in France aren't intellectuals. So that you couldn't really publish a book. Which I thought was probably wrong, but it was kind of, I mean, I do think even more than in the U.S., broadly speaking, kind of the broad intellectual class, especially an older generation, there is not a lot of sports scholarship in France, and it's not, the points of intersection are a little, they're limited, despite the fact that, you know, Bomberger or, if, you know, some of the people, obviously there's some brilliant people writing in France about soccer. So I think that's going to change because, again, as the younger generations are changing it, unfortunately, it's so hard for younger scholars to get, you know, to get a foothold in some ways in France, especially if they're working in new domains that it might. I mean, I feel like in some ways there's some institutional things that make it slower. It's going to make it slower to get incorporated really into the French curriculum, unfortunately. And so that plays a role. But I would I would love to have it translated if that's possible. So hopefully, I will try to keep exploring that. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, if nobody has everything else, I think we can let Laurent go and say thank you again for offering to give us all your thoughts on the book and how it was written and, hopefully We've been seeing the authors hop back in on sessions after presenting on their books, so that's very promising to see, and hopefully we can keep that up and get everyone on board for the next season, because this is our last session for the fall, and there will be things on the website very soon about what's happening in the spring. We've had a very exciting discussion through emails about a possible session on the women's game and maybe splitting that up into books and articles. There's going to be a session we do in Espanol with a book that I brought back from Argentina to engage with some of the researchers that I made connections with there. And then our third book is still up for grabs. We'll be deciding fairly soon on what we'll try and do, and we still have the second half of Goldblatt to cover. So thank you very much, Laurent, for spending your time with us and telling us about the book.
Well, thank you. It's been great. It was an honor to be invited and to speak with you all, so thanks. And I'll definitely join in next spring. It's a great organization. So,
thank you. Well, everyone have a happy holidays and good luck with the tail end of the semesters here.
Okay. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thanks very much, Laurent. Excellent stuff.
And good luck at the conference in Chicago, Alex. I look forward to your report back.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Very
enjoy
exciting.
That.
We'll see which directions it goes in. I know very little about these conferences. The first one I'm going to, but everyone that goes comes back full of energy and ideas about how to use technology in smarter ways. And I really hope this, I think we have a great thing going here with the books, but I hope that one day sort of this can take on a steam of its own. So when I'm taking my comps or writing and buried and don't have the energy for running around with Peter to grab authors, that it can be a little bit more organic on following everyone else's interests and really, helping us with our research, which is the end goal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was one here at Duke that I participated in, and it was great, actually. So I think you'll have a wonderful time. So.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, everyone take care.
Okay. Have a good evening, okay?
Ciao.
Bye-bye. All right. Bye. Ciao.